We'll see if this recorder works a little better now. For Thursday, first hour Thursday, on Canvas, and it will be on the webpage too, there is a list of 20 questions. So you want to download this list of 20 questions and work on them, because we'll go through them the first hour on Thursday. And these will be questions like those on the exam that I want to pull from. Other than that, there's a homework due at 5 today. There's another one posted. We're going to talk and basically finish up the set on institutions today. So I've been talking a lot about banks, and banks being very important to the agricultural sector and the agribusiness sector. Unless you work for Nestle or somebody like that who actually can directly access the capital market. But, you know, we get into debates about things that happen in monetary policy. And this is the effect that when the Federal Open Market Committee meets, you hear a rumor that they're going to raise the federal funds rate or something like that. And the result is a spread through the capital system. So let's step back and look at the banks, because the banks largely are what determines money supply. The nasty secret is that we really can't control money supply directly. We have some interest rates that we try to peg that controls money supply. But money is this big mass of stuff. And as we go through the examples today, I'm hoping to get into a feel for this. So the first bank I want to talk about is the bank that existed in the free banking era. And under this is, I make $1 million investment in common stock. I make $1 million worth of loans. Then what happens? Well, I lend the money, and I assume my interest rate's 5%. I pay my loan officer $5,000. I have $45,000 in profit. So then I declare my dividend rate. So here I'm going to pay a dividend of $35,000 to the owners of the capital. Okay, say a rate of return on their capital of 3.5%. And then what happens is I have additions to retained earnings. Okay, so there's more capital in the bank. And next year's statement balance sheet looks like this. So now instead of having $1 million in cash, I have $1,010,000 in cash. Okay. So, you know, we're going to get more and more into the accounting statements. As a matter of fact, that the next homework that's posted actually asks that you go through the old T accounts. Does everyone remember the T accounts from accounting? You need to do the T accounts just once, maybe twice, once on a test, so that I understand that you understand how these accounting statements actually work. So the idea of the income statement, so $50,000 minus $5,000 for the variable cost, profit $45,000, dividend $35,000, and then I retained earnings of $10,000. So it seems like I'm going backwards. Okay, so we really don't have, well, we have some investment banks left. You know, venture capitalist type organizations where they're raising the stock and they're raising the equity to make these purchases. So, but everybody remembers on last Thursday I put up a series of banknotes. What's a banknote? I guess. Anybody remember? What was a banknote?
Like a CD?
Not really. A banknote was actually a piece of paper that looked like a dollar bill that was issued by the bank. Let's see if I have, I still have one of those up. Silver certificate. Here we go. This is one banknote. It looks just like a U.S. dollar bill. Then there's another banknote like this. So basically, what does this banknote say? It says that if you take this banknote and go to the Merchants Bank of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, it's a strange banknote to have. Does anybody know what's at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas? It's one of the big military stockades, isn't it?
It's a military prison.
Yeah.
So,
you know, if you go into this bank in Leavenworth, Kansas, and you present this, they'll give you $10 worth of specie. And I actually brought a Morgan today to talk about specie. And, okay. So, I'm assuming that they're going to issue some banknote. Okay? Now, so what happens when I issue a banknote? When I issue the banknotes out, some of them come back, right? So right away, some people say, I want to own specie, I want to own coin, I want to own real money. And part of them stay out. Part of them recirculate in the local economy. Everyone's heard of military scrip? Yes? No? Anybody been paid in military scrip? So military scrip is, instead of getting dollars in some post, they give you basically banknotes, so that they're not real money outside the military. Okay, so let's think about this one. Let's go back to this banknote. So this banknote, I'm going to issue $1 million in banknotes. So I have cash. I'm going to put out cash and take away the banknotes. And I'm going to lend money. And I'm going to lend money short and long term. Okay? Now, so what happens is that I pass out these banknotes and I loan $1 million. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that about $50,000 of these banknotes will stay in circulation out there. These banknotes represent a liability to the bank. Okay, and what's going to happen here is that I'm going to hold on hand $50,000 in cash to pay those banknotes if they come wandering back in. Okay, does everyone understand this transaction? Okay, now the great thing about this is, how much lending did I do? I did $1 million in lending, right? How much cash am I going to use? Basically, I'm going to keep $50,000 of cash on hand, okay, to do this lending. So it expands the amount of commerce that's going around. Okay, now, suppose that I have $50,000 worth of banknotes wandering out there after I've done this issue and it's all come back again. Do I really have to hold $50,000 worth of cash? What do you think? Some of those people may never turn that banknote back in again, right? They'll just continue to circulate. So how much cash do I need to hold on hand? About what I expect anyone to claim at any point in time. So here I'm saying, well, I'm going to say that there's a maximum of $25,000 that I expect to come wandering back to the door. Let me ask a question. Who determines the amount of cash, dollar bills, 20s, 100s, in the economy at any one point in time? You know? You do. Why? Is that the bank keeps enough cash on hand to do what? So if somebody wanders in and says, I have a checking account here and I want a $50 bill, they give you a $50 bill and credit your account for the 50, right? They give you the cash, they take it out of your account. So at any one point in time, the amount of cash currency out there, hard bill, is a function of is we have credit cards, we have ATMs. Nobody, I mean, I can't remember the last time I had a $100 bill in my pocket, right? Or maybe that's what my wife does to me, I don't know. But anyway, I don't carry much cash because I just see you don't. So what happens when we put this banknote out there is it allows us to do a little more lending. If you will, we're doing lending on the cash flow. Does that make sense? Because I don't think that any one day all that cash is going to come back in. I can lend a little more than I would have lent. Those cash, those banknotes, represent potential liability, but not actual liability at any one point in time. Because I don't know how many people are going to come in and say, I want a hard bill. I've got two today. Put these up. One of these is a Morgan, the other is an Eagle. A Morgan is 1 troy ounce of silver. And it was at one time worth about a buck. So, in the day of these banks, what were they doing? If you bring in a $10 bill, they would hand you 10 Morgans. Nobody else has this type of currency floating around. Now, so in a lot of ways, a banknote is like a super checking account. Does that make sense? A banknote is like a super checking account. It's this thing that I started up and put out there that allows for transactions. So before now, these banks really weren't what we think about as true banks. Why? They didn't accept deposits. So now let's move to a bank that actually accepts deposits. So I'm going to look at this balance sheet that says, I'm going to take in $500,000 in deposits payable. I'm going to have $50,000 of banknotes, and I'm going to have $1 million in common stock. Okay? So in total, I can lend what? $1,550,000. Right? That's how much equity, that's how much claim I have. And my point is, initially when I take these deposits in, I have $525,000 in cash. Where did that come from? It came from the $500,000 in deposits and the $25,000 in banknotes. And I already lived out my common stock, $525,000 short-term, $500,000 long-term, okay? So what's the question this bank faces? This bank faces it's got $525,000 of lendable cash in its balance sheet, its tills. So what do they want to do? They want to lend it, right? So what's the question they face?
How to do it.
Well, how much cash do I keep on hand? It's just like the banknote. How much ready cash do I have to keep on hand because somebody was going to write a check? And when they write a check, I'm going to be forced to come up with hard cash for that check, right? So I have to decide how much I'm going to lend, okay? So as a first decision, I'm going to say I'm going to keep an eighth of it on hand, okay? Now, this is identical. We talked about it a little bit as a reserve requirement. Everybody remember from the last lecture what a reserve requirement was? What was a reserve requirement? And the reserve requirement is now comprised of what? Cash and deposits with the Federal Reserve System. Okay. So that's my reserve requirement. That's how much cash I want to keep on hand in case somebody walks in with a check and I have to pay it out somehow. Okay. So if I keep an eighth of my cash and my deposits on hand, I can lend $437,500 additional lending. Okay? So my new balance sheet becomes $87,500 in cash. I'm going to assume that they put all those loans in short term. They're most liquid. And $500,000 in long term. And then I still have the same identical equity side of this balance sheet. Does everybody understand what just happened? Short-term rates and long-term notes, and my opportunity cost, the money I could lend, is in my cash reserve, my cash and credit reserve, okay? So, the idea here is that, okay, two things. One, I make a lot more money. Where do I make my money at? I make my money on your deposits. Right? I make my money on your deposits. I'm going to lend them out. Okay? So when a bank takes in deposits and checking accounts, what's the assumption? Every night I close it out and I have a given amount of checking accounts, right? And a given amount of fluid cash. So I close out my checking account. I know how much checks I have. Okay? Now, based upon that amount, I compute my reserve requirement. Okay? My reserve requirement tells me how much cash I have to keep on hand in cash and deposits at the Fed. Then the rest of it is something I can lend out. Okay? Now, every night when I do this, some banks are positive and some banks are negative. So some banks don't have enough money basically at the Fed. Some banks have more money than they need at the Fed. Okay? So this gap is another capital market called the federal funds market. So banks borrow from other banks on the federal funds market to give them cash at the Fed. Okay? Is this, what kind of constraint is this? When we talked about banking regulations, we talked about two types of banking regulations, right? Anybody remember the two types of banking regulations? No? One was capital adequacy, which is basically what? What does capital adequacy tell us? And solvency. It says, do I have enough assets on hand to support my lending portfolio? What's the other regulation? It's the reserve requirement. What's the reserve requirement? It's liquidity constraint. Okay? So at the end of the night, if I close these banks out in their Federal Reserve account, and one of them's negative and one of them's positive, what kind of a failure is that? Capital adequacy or liquidity? That's a liquidity problem, right? I don't have enough cash on hand, possibly today, to meet all my requirements. Okay, that's a liquidity problem. So I borrow from another bank, which means I issue debt, but what do I get back when I issue that debt? I get cash on hand. I get a credit in my federal funds account. Okay? So does everybody see how this balancing act happens? Yes? No? So you've had this in macro before? Okay. Now, so banks. So what's happening here believe it or not, the next set of assumptions. I've lent this $1,550,000 out. What happens to that money? It just poofs off into the nowhere. What happens to that money? Somebody gets it, right? Homeowner or a home construction agent gets it. What do they do with it when they get it? They deposit it, first off, right? They put it back in a bank, okay? So, on this balance sheet, if I were the only bank in town, what would happen is my deposits would go up, right? This happens one day. The next day, what happens is this money goes out. Let's make it $1,462,500 goes out. Then what happens? This money is out. A bunch of people have it in their pockets. Then they go to the bank and they deposit it again. Okay? So in theory, my deposits could go up by as much as what? Basically, the change in money is equal to the shock of money to the economy times 1 over 1 minus delta, where delta is the reserve requirements. Okay? So, basically, these banks create money. Yes? The banks, by their very operation, create money. Everybody see that? By the fact that I lend it back out again, and this time I only lend again 1/8 of my $1,462,500. So if that happens over and over and over again, the total amount of money created by the economy is 1/1 - 1/8 times my initial shock, the amount of capital I put into the system, my M0. Okay? Yes? Everybody sees that. Who creates money? The banking system creates money. The banking system creates money by the capital markets operation. Okay? Now, so, it works in reverse, too. Okay? So, if suddenly, out of the blue, a shock to the economy happens, and less money is available in the economy, what happens? The whole thing works in reverse. The bank can put out fewer notes. It has to call loans to make its liquidity requirement, and money supply declines. Okay? So this also happens when we increase or decrease interest rates. So if the Fed increases the interest rate, what happens? If the Fed increases the interest rate, the demand for loanable funds go down, and what? The money multiplier works backwards. Okay. So, one of the biggest crises in the U.S. history was the Great Depression. Everybody heard the Great Depression? What did you hear about the Great Depression? What caused the I always hear is, what is it, Smoot-Hawley tariffs? Tariffication? Okay. One of the big things that caused the Great Depression, whatever the genesis was, is that people stopped, they took some of their deposits out. of my favorite economists, Milton Friedman, typically argues that the Great Depression could have been stopped if the Federal Reserve System would have put enough cash in the system. Okay, the cash in the system would have prevented the money multiplier from working backwards as banks contracted their loans portfolios. Okay, there's another artifact in the Federal Reserve System that I haven't touched on. There's something called a discount window. Has anyone heard of the discount window? The discount window is a direct borrowing line with the Federal Reserve System. Okay, so if I have a bank, especially an agricultural bank, that has seasonal fluctuations in my cash available, I can borrow money from the Fed under the discount window. Actually, I take a note in, and instead of giving me a dollar, they give me 95 cents on the loan, and I pay it, I get it back at a dollar. Okay. So, what I'm really tuning in on is the focus of this, the banks. We think about banks from a business standpoint. That's where we go and we get a lot of our capital. Like I said, agriculture and agribusinesses usually cannot gain their capital by issuing common stock on the stock market. They do it mostly through debt. So we typically talk a lot about banks from the idea that they supply credit to firms. But the other thing we have to talk about banks is banks are pivotal in the way society creates money supply. Okay? And how this whole thing, how the world turns on money supply. So like I was saying before, currently there is a question. Anyone remember, what was quantitative easing? Anybody refer to quantitative easing? No? What was quantitative easing? Quantitative easing said that the federal government issued a lot of bonds, banks bought the bonds, the banks sold the bonds to the Federal Reserve System, they kept the interest rate low. Okay? What's happening now? We're trying to reverse quantitative easing. As we're trying to reverse quantitative easing, exactly, say 70% of the bonds will be repurchased when they come due out of the Federal Reserve System each quarter. Okay, so 30% of that money has to come from somewhere else. Where? Who do you think that 30% is going to probably come from? Banks. Banks love government bonds. Okay. So what we're dealing with now is, how contractionary is this going to be as we start trouncing out, as we start buying the government bonds off the market? So that's the current policy issue. The other issue we get into sometimes is that changes in money supply are related to basically changes in gross domestic product and changes in the inflation rate. So if the money supply is out of control and growing too fast, we get increases in the inflation rate. Basically, we do not change the reserve requirement now. That's considered a blunt instrument. If we were to change the reserve requirement 5%, we could probably crash the economy. So what we work with is the federal funds rate. Okay. So does everyone see last set of slides? So I've been focusing on the interaction between banks, money supply, and borrowing and lending in the capital market. There's another concept out there. One is that there's a relationship between the capital market and the exchange market, exchange rates. Have you covered this in your macro classes? What happens is, as the interest rate in the U.S. goes up, what happens to the exchange rate? What happens to the price of the dollar? Anyone know? What happens if the U.S. interest rate goes up? What happens to the demand for investments denominated in dollars? It increases. So what happens if, how do you purchase an asset valued in U.S. dollars? You've got to acquire U.S. dollars, right? Okay, so as the interest rate goes up, the exchange rate goes up, okay? So is an increase in the exchange rate a good thing or a bad thing for U.S. agriculture? You think that U.S. agriculture is a net importer or a net exporter? Net exporter, right? So what happens is the exchange rate goes up.
It becomes more expensive to export the goods, so we'd be hurting the agriculture.
The demand for agriculture shifts backward, and the price goes down. Okay. So 1979, third quarter, October, was a perfect storm. We had been working on a loose money regime, and inflation was fairly high, but the real interest rate was fairly low. The Fed Reserve Chairman at that time, Paul Volcker, moved to increase. He wanted to take inflation out of the system. So how do you take inflation out of the system? You slow the growth of money supply. So he slowed the growth of money supply, and what happened? The real interest rate, we'll get to the difference between real and nominal. The real interest rate went up. As the real interest rate goes up, our money supply does contract, but agriculture's hit two ways. Agriculture has at that time, had significantly more debt. And especially people that were on the margin, that were doing a lot of growth and a lot of high dollar productivity, they had a lot of debt. Okay? So they had debt, the real interest rate goes up, they're in a cash flow crunch, and at the same time what happens is the exchange rate goes up and the prices fall. Okay, and the idea is that the taken together, the two caused the U.S. agricultural sector to go into basically a financial crisis that it took us a while to work on. But this crisis happened from two components. It happened because Volcker decreased the money supply to try to get a handle on inflation, and because decreasing the money supply caused the trade effect to come back through. Okay. So basically, it's what I want to say about the way agricultural banks and banks in general fit in the money supply system, how they support, how they expand money supply, how they contract money supply, and how this system looks. To understand what's going on, you get headlines every day. I'm always, you know, this guy gets up on CNN or something in the morning and says, the market went down 500 points today in fears of blank. Okay? I don't trust him. I don't think he knows what's going on. So the fear I have, and the true fear would be, if the Federal Reserve was going to make a move on the dollar, on the interest rate. So what's the real interest rate now? How many people got T-bill 0.75, one? Yes? That's cheap money. That's cheap money. So a lot is based on that, but just feeling how the agriculture, how the demand for capital through the banking institutions affects money supply, and it feeds back to affect the interest rates. Okay, so that's all I had today. Here are the here's the quiz, and I have the work over here. If you want to see the work. Future ones, I can make that change. For today's, I better leave it at 5.
Thank you. I don't get off work till like 8 o'clock, and it's not like I wait till last. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I just need the extra lecture to, you know what I mean, to get
Okay, well, I'll make it midnight.
Okay,
I don't think that Scott's going to grade them before midnight.
Okay.